This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the news this week, Boston police arrest more than 120 Occupy Boston protesters, and Mayor Tom Menino lays down a hard line.
Enough's enough. We'll tolerate demonstrations. We'll tolerate expressions of free speech. But when it comes to civil disobedience, we have a real issue with that.
Meanwhile, GOP presidential hopefuls occupy New Hampshire for another debate, where the plain-talking pizza mogul Herman Cain emerged as a top challenger to former Governor Mitt Romney.
Governor Romney, can you name all 59 points in your 160-page plan? And does it satisfy that criteria of being simple, transparent, efficient, fair, and neutral?
And back in Massachusetts, a decades-long debate inched closer to a conclusion as the state Senate approved a bill to legalize casino gambling.
This is an economic development bill, and it's going to create jobs, and we have over 250,000 people out of work in the Commonwealth.
Joining us now to dig into our Week in Review panel, Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe, joins us right here in the studio. Scott Lehigh, great to have you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And from New Hampshire, James Pindle, political director at WMUR-TV, joins us as well. He's with us on the line from St. Anselm's College in Manchester. And James Pindle, great to have you.
Thanks for having me back on.
Well, this week, as we mentioned in that open, Boston was part of a growing story across the nation, from Occupy Wall Street to Chicago to Seattle. A popular protest movement against economic inequality appears to be gaining numbers, passion, and strength. Early Tuesday morning, after protesters tried to expand their encampment on the Rose Kennedy Greenway, police moved in and arrested more than 120 of them. Scott, let me start with you. What did you make of these arrests and what it says about the future of this young protest movement?
Well, they're in a pretty constrained space there. And you drive by it, and I was by the other day in the rain, and they're looking pretty bedraggled. And if you were going camping, you wouldn't want to be shoved in that closed space. So they're obviously looking for some more area. Mayor Menino considers that his personal grass, I think. He doesn't want him on it. Yeah. I thought the police kind of overreacted on the thing. You never like to see police wading into a group of protesters. And it looks to me as though the mayor has kind of walked that back. In the days since then, said, well, as long as they don't do this and that, they can stay. That I have to say, I'm a little underwhelmed by the protest itself. I don't think it has much of a coherent message and any action points, and it seems to be a little parodic in terms of process and general assemblies, and everyone has to repeat this and that. But in general, I think protesters it's a protected form of speech, and they deserve some respect.
Well, you mentioned that the mayor sort of pulled back a little bit from his initial position. And in fact, a spokesman said after Menino made statements to us and other members of the media that there's got to be a limit. A spokesman said there is no time limit as long as the protesters maintain an atmosphere conducive to public safety. James Pindle, what do you make of the protest? Scott, they're not so impressed with the message or the coherence. What do you see from your vantage point?
Look, I think we're in a period of time that is begging for a style of populism in our politics. I don't know if that's going to come from the left. Certainly last year it came from the right and the Tea Party movement that came out of that. You know, it's a conversation about elites or versus economic, the political elites versus sort of economic elites. It's kind of where this debate is headed. Clearly, you look at the economic disparity in this country, the largest gaps we've seen since probably the Gilded Age. You see that incomes have been pretty much flat, wages have been flat since the 1970s. You have this enormous amount of economic anxiety, and there's no way to really channel this anger. So sometimes it's when the Tea Party, I think, that on this side with the Occupy movement, I'm not sure people have really thought it through enough. There isn't, as Scott mentioned, a coherent message. I'm also not quite sure what the Occupy itself really does. Are they going to be there for 3 months, 4 months?
They're talking in Boston about getting ready and camping there over the winter, James, which I will say, if they manage that, it'll be kind of a freezerie, and I will have a huge amount of respect for them if they endure through a chilly Boston winter, but I'm skeptical on that point.
And, of course, politically here, if this starts to dissipate, people have to go do a job, they have to do whatever, then it's going to be seen as a negative sign for the movement versus a Tea Party rally, which can come and be there for 3 hours and leave, and you go back to your regular life.
So you're saying if they have to decamp at some point because, let's say, it's 20 below for 2 weeks, that'll be seen as a defeat, in a sense.
I don't know if it's seen as a defeat, but they're going to have to figure out the politics of that,
sure,
and why, you know, they can come back or not, if it's a good enough excuse. Obviously, 20 degrees below, I won't be covering them.
But well, interesting point of view that we had earlier this week on the program. We talked to a couple of people who were involved with the 60s protests and really involved in the anti-Vietnam movements. And one of the people we had on the show made the point that at the beginning of that movement, I mean, it took years and years for it to gain steam. And it was interesting that he saw similarities to what they were going through in the early days of the organization around the anti-war movement back in the 60s. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I think the people in the anti-war movement had a very concrete idea of what they wanted. They wanted the end of the war.
Right.
And this group, if this group were saying, okay, we want the passage of the president's jobs bill, or we want that in a reversion to the tax rates of the 1990s, is something you could get your hands and your head around and say, this is what this movement is about. Right now, I have to confess, I don't have much of an idea other than an expression of as James says, discontent with the economic situation in the country. Well, everyone is discontent with it. I mean, it's not a, that's not a, I mean, not everyone, but 80, 89, 90% of the people are. I just think that to be an effective protest, you have to have focused, have funneled your energy towards some goals.
Well, meanwhile, this Occupy movement continues to grow and spread with protests this weekend planned in London, New Zealand, Frankfurt, and more. Even closer to home, James, we learned Concord, New Hampshire, your neck of the woods. What's the perspective of the Occupy movement in New Hampshire?
You know, it really has not driven the type of buzz that it has in Boston. Clearly, there haven't been arrests. I mean, in Concord, we had 100 people show up for one day in White Park. In Manchester, there were about 50 people. That's, of course, the state's largest city. It just really hasn't taken a hold. It's been much more of an urban development. But we have found a lot of people from New Hampshire, actually, if they're into it, they'll go to Boston beginning in the early phases of this thing. So I haven't really seen it grow here. It may. And clearly, much of the action has been on Republican politics in this state. So those who are on the left, this gives them an outlet to do something.
Sure. Well, speaking of that, let's stay in New Hampshire and talk about Republican outlets and move on to presidential politics. This week, the 8 Republican hopefuls debated at Dartmouth College. Now, according to the latest polls, Mitt Romney is a front runner, but so is Herman Cain, the plain-spoken former CEO of Godfather's Pizza. His big idea, scrap the current tax system with something he calls 999, which we'll talk about in a minute. But first, let's listen to Herman Cain going after Mitt Romney. Here he is.
The 999 plan that I have proposed is simple, transparent, efficient, fair, and neutral. My question is to Governor Romney. Can you name all 59 points in your 160-page plan, and does it satisfy that criteria of being simple, transparent, efficient, fair, and neutral?
Herman, I've had the experience of my life of taking on some tough problems, and I must admit that simple answers are always very helpful, but oftentimes inadequate.
Now, I know these debates aren't always thrilling, and regardless of your political perspective, there are moments, though, that just make this this season just a joy to behold. I think that was one of them.
I think that he Herman Cain is actually quite a good debater. He's very pleasant and personable, which you can't say for all. I mean, Rick Santorum always acts so angry, and Newt Gingrich acts like a crazy man half the time. But I find Cain he's kind of fun to listen to. And that was a good moment. I will say, just in terms of taxation, here's a basic truism: flatter is never fairer.
Right. But
when you say flat, what you're saying is you are going to shift a burden. If you have a progressive system, you're going to shift the burden of the taxation downward onto other people, and particularly, and then you're going to go to a sales tax, which is going to hit all kinds of people and take more income from people of lesser means than it will for the wealthy.
James, I want to come to you on this, but just for our listeners who might not be completely up to date, what the 999 proposal is: a 9% flat 9% income tax, 9% business transaction tax, and a 9% federal sales tax. And what's your take on how Herman Cain is sort of changing the dynamic or affecting the dynamic of that race and his proposal?
I think a lot of people up here are just trying to figure out why he is really catching on the way he is. I mean, right now, the sense is he's like an internet stock that has gone up very dramatically. And if he is to have any chance of sustaining this, he will need to build an infrastructure that is, quite frankly, very much lacking. He doesn't have a lot of money in his campaign. He's got two staffers here who've never worked in New Hampshire politics. And he's got some excitement around him, but he's going to have to develop that into something much more substantive. It's the same story in Iowa and in South Carolina. But look, if Herman Cain, who struggled a bit later in the week to describe his 999 plan and how it worked, because, again, according to his plan, he actually scraps the 999 and goes to a straight consumption tax, very much European style, to 30% of the sales tax. And so he's got to explain how this works. But let me say this for a second. I mean, he is obviously a very much of a dynamic speaker who's always really interested folks. One of the best speakers you could have at your county spaghetti dinner for the local Republican Party. And he's always been sought out for that. But if he can get off the 999 and actually get into his life story, this guy has got a more of an American story than Mitt Romney and Barack Obama put together. I mean, he's a really dramatic, inspiring, interesting story. Obviously, he's trying to sell some books on his memoir telling that story. But I think people could really be captured by him. But it's the fundamentals. As we know in New England, we may love the Red Sox, but that has probably no correlation to how well they're going to do during the season. And again, people, there's kind of more of a correlation in politics. If you like the guy, they tend to do pretty well. You, after all, vote for them. But he's going to have to bring out his people to vote. Herman Cain is in second place in three polls the last week.
And first right now, in the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll.
National poll, which the nation, we don't have a national primary. But the second place in the last three New Hampshire polls. And I will tell you right now, if the New Hampshire primary was held right now, and heck, who knows when it'll be held? Maybe it's tomorrow.
Coming soon. Sooner.
Herman Cain will not finish second.
Well, it's interesting how Mitt Romney has been the man to beat. Michelle Bachmann had her moment, then Rick Perry had his moment. Now it seems to be Herman Cain. It'll be interesting to see what kind of staying power he has. Speaking of Rick Perry, he hasn't fared so well in recent debates. He spent a lot of time preparing for the one this week. Here he is taking a swipe at Romney, citing criticism by a former Romney aide of the Massachusetts health care law.
Romney Care has driven the cost of small business insurance premiums up by 14% over the national average in Massachusetts. So my question for you would be, how would you respond to his criticism of your signature legislative achievement?
Now, Romney apparently was prepared for that question. Here's how he responded.
I'm proud of what we were able to accomplish. I'll tell you this, though. We have the lowest number of kids as a percentage uninsured of any state in America. You have the highest. I'm still speaking. We have less than 1% of our kids. They're uninsured. You have a million kids uninsured in Texas. A million kids. Under President Bush, the percentage uninsured went down. Under your leadership, it's gone up.
So pretty tough comeback there from Mitt Romney, Scott.
Mitt really boxed his ears there. Yeah, Perry. What we've seen is Rick Perry is not a good debater. Hmm. Now, Mitt's moment in the debate, I thought, was a little bit hurt when he mispronounced the name of one of his chief financial, Glenn Hubbard. I think he called him Glenn Hutchinson, didn't he?
Oh boy.
Perry made kind of a wry note of that later in the debate. But look, Romney is a good debater. He's been around. He's done this before. And he's very prepared. And you know, Perry, I got to say, he has not comported himself well. He was a little better this debate than the last one when he just had a disastrous answer. But this was very unimpressive. He sat there like a stone for most of the debate.
Was that your take, James?
Look, Mitt Romney, I think we saw in this debate this week, really turned himself into a general election candidate. Mm-hmm. He stopped playing Republican primary kind of politics. Certainly he's not going to walk away from it, but we saw some subtle shifts in language. I mean, remember with that line about healthcare, he flips it around and says, look, I care about kids. I care about insuring kids, and flipped it back around on Rick Perry. You heard some other statements during the day. Granted, just hours before that debate, he was endorsed by Chris Christie, the new popular New Jersey governor, one of the biggest endorsements out there left to be had. If I don't know who anyone else would really be much bigger at this point. And so it's leading to a conversation this week on whether or not Mitt Romney is the inevitable nominee. Right now, of course, he's not. It's too early. People haven't made up their minds. No one's really fell in love with Mitt Romney over the last 5 years he's been running for president. But it's going to lead to that conversation. I think you've seen some subtle shifts from him going that way. And the one thing, major feather in his cap, is that in a number of these polls in different states, including here in New Hampshire, he is the only candidate who has a strong lead over Barack Obama in a head-to-head contest. And as we get closer to Election Day, electability is going to be a big factor for these Republicans. More than they want anything else, they want to beat Barack Obama.
Mm. Here's an interesting thing, though. Talking again about the Journal NBC poll, one of the things in that, they ask specifically, what would you rather have, a candidate whose views are closer to yours, if you had to pick one of these qualities, a candidate whose views are closer to yours, or someone who would have a better chance of winning? And fully two-thirds of the people in that poll said it would be more important to have someone who favored their views. Now, I think that's because this year the Republicans are, they believe, and I think wrongly, that almost any nominee will beat Barack Obama. And I think they've got themselves into that mindset. But that's part of the resistance to Mitt. If you look at the same numbers, a lot of people just don't think he really believes what they believe. They don't think he's an honest conservative, and they don't think he adheres to all the different dogma the party has.
Gentlemen, let's move on to legalized gambling in Massachusetts. It's getting closer. The state Senate passed the gambling bill, and after differences are worked out with the House, Governor Patrick is expected to sign it into law. At the top of the segment, we heard Senate President Therese Murray talking about this as a jobs bill. Others say it will bring higher crime rates, addiction, and corruption. Scott Lehigh, what's your take on this, which has been years in the making? It died the last time. What's your view?
Well, I'm vaguely in favor of it, I guess. I mean, I think it'd be interesting to see whether we can sustain three casinos. I mean, I don't really think, given that there's gambling all over New England, that the question is you're not keeping people from gambling if you don't build casinos. You just keep them from gambling in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously there's going to be some construction jobs, and the employment jobs, the actual dealer jobs, the other jobs at casinos are reasonably good jobs. They're not minimum wage jobs. You get a lot of tips. So I guess I would say I'm vaguely optimistic about it.
James, no casinos yet in New Hampshire. Will you be making trips to Massachusetts to hit those tables?
Well, there's renewed conversation about what we're going to do in terms of gambling in this state in response to what's happening in Massachusetts. There's new momentum in the last 3 weeks. There's been a series of meetings in Concord with legislative leaders to see if anything else, to try to get something going in terms of racinos at Rockingham Park, which, of course, is right on the border in Salem, New Hampshire. I'm not sure how quickly that could happen, but there is renewed talk because of what's happening in Massachusetts.
Interesting. Okay, time now for our hubbub, those stories that sort of fell below the fold, that a little bit below the radar this week. Meghna, I want to bring you back into this conversation. Your hubbub.
So mine has to do with the MBTA. I'll admit my favorite form of transportation other than my feet, because I'm very pro public transit as a concept, but not pro it when people don't get off the train to let other people's on. And I'm looking at you, Beeline student riders, who don't take your backpacks off and stand near the door on the green line. Well, the T is also thinking about you, because they are yet again starting another sort of Be a Civil Rider campaign. It follows their No Groping and No Littering campaign, so their targets are a little questionable. But they're going to have these new placards out that say, you know, courtesy shouldn't be big news. And it's like a fake tear of the top of a newspaper that says, passenger refrains from loud cell phone conversation. I wish them all the luck in the world.
You don't sound optimistic.
I know. And sometimes I just wonder, will it take away from some of the charm of riding the T if everyone suddenly behaved?
Okay. Scott Lehigh, what do you have for us?
Well, next week is the week that the Globe moves BostonGlobe.com moves behind a paywall. You'll have to be a subscriber for it. We're hoping that people will come over for it. It's less than $4 a week by a penny, at $3.99 a week. If you've got a subscription of any kind to the Globe, it's free. There are going to be lots of extras for insiders, and we think it's going to be a hugely exciting experience, and I'm hoping that people will migrate that way and help us continue some of the great journalism we do.
So I agree about the great journalism. You're a booster, obviously. Is it going to work, do you think? Is it financially viable?
I believe it is, yeah. I think the business has to go this way, and I think that we have a good plan, and I think the audience, you know, and readers appreciate what the paper does, so I think it will work, yes.
Well, we wish you luck. James Pindle, your hubbub this week.
Well, I'm going to go to sports a little bit. Is it me, or does anyone not seem to be like realizing or freaking out by the fact that the NBA season is about to get canceled and like no one cares? And I do have a theory behind this. I'm wondering that if it's in Boston, it's not that we're consumed with Theo and the Red Sox and that the Patriots are doing fine, the Bruins are back. I'm wondering if there's like in the subconscious, we know that if it's only a 40-game season, that's like really good for our really old but competent team to get it all the way.
That's a good idea. I think shortening the NBA season isn't a bad thing. It seems to start in October and end in, I don't know, September. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on.
Well, they need to talk to New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner, and maybe he can move it up or something. I don't know.
All right. Here's my hubbub. It's a terrific impersonation of Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren that's gone viral. It's produced by someone named Edie M. Geller. It features an uncanny lookalike of Warren. And while her voice isn't perfect, she has the cadence and the themes down perfectly. Let's listen to a sample.
You built a factory out there. Good for you. But you don't have to be such a about it. You should pay your fair share. We're all very excited that you made a killing selling those little USB thumb drives shaped like tiny hamburgers. But let me be clear. You moved your USB hamburgers to market on roads that the rest of us paid for. I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I will fix this myself if I have to.
Okay, so that's a Elizabeth Warren sound-alike and look-alike. If you go to YouTube and Google it, it's a lot of fun. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in. Scott Lehigh, columnist of the Boston Globe, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Pindle, political director at WMUR-TV in Manchester, thank you and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Up next, historian Kenneth C. Davis tests our knowledge, that is, the knowledge of Meghna and me, and it's embarrassing, of New England history. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.